Also looking forward to hearing from Lavelle Moten, North Carolina Central University head men's basketball coach, who joins us now here on Sunday morning on ESPN Radio. Lavelle, thank you very much for doing this and making this time. There's really no simple or easy way to just get into this conversation, but I just wonder how the last week has hit you, a black man as a men's basketball coach and a leader of young black men.
Well, it's hit me differently, and not for the reason that you explained, to say that, you know, black man, yes, that was palpable, but not necessarily as the leader of a basketball team, but as a black man who had a similar, very similar incident where guns was drawn to my head probably 15 years ago that I kept under the table because a passenger at the time was the guy who's the godfather of my kids, Raymond Felton, and it was a month before he was going to get drafted. So I didn't want any negative cloud around his draft stock to affect his family, so I kind of kept it on the wrap. So to say the least, seeing it not only on social media but just on TV and just seeing the death of anyone and it becoming a culmination of all of these things, you know, it really affected me.
Lavelle, I don't want to make you talk about things that you don't want to talk about because it's much more difficult to verbalize and speak these right. truths that have happened than it is to tweet them like you right. did in a great Twitter thread. But I also think it's helpful, Lavelle, to just really paint the picture about what happened and what your history is. Could you just walk us through as best you can and as comfortable as you can what happened in May of 2005?
Yeah, you know, I mean, let's be clear. That was the first time. That wasn't my first altercation with the police or interaction with the police, right? That was the first time a policeman had actually put a gun in my head. And so that's why I really tweeted about that. You know, I told someone and, you know, I received a call from my mayor apologizing, and she had nothing to do with it. This was, you know, when I was a kid. But I told her, I said, look, my first interaction with the police, I was 12 years old. I was coming back. Well, maybe four blocks down from my housing projects was this place called Historic Oakwood where, you know, affluent people lived. And I would sell magazine subscriptions to fundraise for my AAU trips because my mother couldn't afford it. And as I'm walking back from Historic Oakwood, I'm counting my money, and a cop is like driving like 2 miles an hour beside me. He's parallel. And he says, I'm probably 12 years old. He said, boy, where you get that money from? And I continued to walk because I wasn't anybody's boy, right? And so I continued to walk. And he said, boy, did you hear me? Well, I said, where'd you get that money from? That's dope money, ain't it? Implying that or insinuating that, you know, it was drug money. And I said, nah, and I kept walking. So he proceeded. He drove in front of me, cut me off, made me spread eagle on the car. He went in my pockets checking for drugs or whatever. And he found a wad of money from the magazine subscriptions and also the money that I had in my hand. And he took the money. He drove off, and I went home crying. But, you know, what people have to understand is that those things, we're so marginalized and targeted on a day-to-day basis in the areas that we come from. When I went home, I was crying not because he humiliated me. I was crying because I didn't think I would be able to go on my AAU trip because I no longer had my money, right? And so that was common thread. On 2005, I think it was May because it was right after North Carolina won the national championship. I was a high school coach at the time, and I'm driving, and I have a UConn Denali with tinted windows, and I'm driving through my old neighborhood. I no longer live here, but I'm driving through my old neighborhood to see some of my friends and some of my family that still stay there. I have my mother on the cell phone, and Raymond Felton, point guard of North Carolina, and, you know, went on to play in the NBA for probably 12 years. He's in the passenger seat, and I'm like a big brother to Raymond even to this day. He's the best man in my wedding and vice versa. He's the godfather to my kids, et cetera. So we're driving, and I look in my rear view, and I see the cop following me. And I tell my mom, I said, Mom, I'm going to call you back because I know I'm about to get pulled. She said, nah, you're not about to call me back. She said, you stay on the phone with me. So he's following me for probably like 5 minutes. So I'm making turns that if you're not from our neighborhood, no one in the world would make those turns. So I'm just deliberately making these turns to see if he's following me. And he's making the same turn. So I say, okay, I know he's following me. So it's only a matter of time. And then all of a sudden, the siren and the lights come on. So once the siren and the lights come on, I pull to the side of the road and I tell my mom, you know, I'm going to call you back. And she said, no, you make sure you stay on the phone with me. As soon as I pull over, when I put the truck in park, the cop runs. He yanks my door open and then tries to yank me out the car, out the door. He's never asked for driver's license registration, none of the routine, none of the protocol, none of that. When he tries to yank me, I don't go out the car because I have my seatbelt on. So I unclick my seatbelt, and he jerks me out the car. When he jerks me out the car, his partner has the gun pointed at me and said, turn your black ass around. So I get on the truck, and I spread eagle, and I'm looking like, what is going on? So every time I look back, his partner moves the gun a little closer. So this guy's frisking my pockets, and he's trying to get me to spread eagle. And the way he's doing it, he's kicking me in my ankles, right? So forcing me to spread my legs and making me continue to put my hand on the truck or whatever. I'm hearing my mom frantically come through the phone because I put the phone down on the armrest. Now, mind you, they don't even know Raymond is in the car because Raymond is on the passenger side and it has tinted windows, and they both ran up on my side. So I guess they call for backup, and they're asking me or telling me I need to search that car. And I said, no, you're not searching my car. You're not searching my truck. And they're like, why? You're dope boys, ain't you? You dope boys. I know you got dope in the car. And I was like, well, you got no dope in the car. Anyone that know me and Ray know we're the most square guys ever. We've never drank or smoked anything in our life, right? So, but you're still not searching my truck because your presentation was just horrible. So he cuffs me. He takes my head. And mind you, it's raining outside. I have on all white because we're going to an all-white event. He cuffs me. He takes my head. He takes me to the back of my truck and slams me down on the concrete and says, hit your ass right here. So I guess he called for backup because now he's asking me for my driver's license. He's asking me to go in the truck and get my driver's license. And I said, no, I'm not going in there to reach for my license so you can shoot me, right? Because at this time, I really don't trust him. So maybe a couple of minutes later, his backup drives up, and it looked like he's trying to run me over. His backup drives up on the curve where I'm sitting, and he stops the car probably like 5-6 feet away from me, and he get out the car. Now he has guns drawn because his partners had guns drawn, so he's just approaching the scene with the same energy that he sees on the scene, right? And so his partner's buddy gets out the car, and he's looking at me like as if I look familiar. And so he goes and brings everyone to the side, and they huddle up, and all I hear is like Lavelle Moten, and they all kind of looking back at me. Right. And that partner comes over. He says, man, what is your name? And I said, Lavelle Moten. And I've been trying to tell them that forever. And he goes back over there. And they say, man, let me see your license. Go in the truck. I said, I'm not going in this truck to get my license. I have memorized my driver's license number since I was 15 for circumstances to be prepared such as this. So I tell them my driver's license number. And by that time, my mom is still crying on the phone. And now Ray rolls down his window, and when Ray did that, he scared them to death because, again, they never knew Ray was in the truck, right? And so they run up, and they got their hand on their gun, and when they run up to Ray, they said, man, this is Raymond Felton. And, you know, we're on Tobacco Road. I don't know where you guys are located right now, but on Tobacco Road, I mean, you've heard the impact of Carolina Duke and NC State and so on and so forth. So it's real heavy, and people are really noticeable around here, especially right after winning the national championship. So, you know, they notice Ray, and then they go back and they huddle up, and the cops say, man, I told y'all that was Raymond Felton, Lavelle Moten, or whatever. So one of them get out the car, the initial officer, and then he comes over, and he extends his hand to apologize. He said, man, I'm sorry, we just got a call that y'all fit the description, and, you know, I want bygones to be bygones, and I don't want to leave here with you thinking I'm a butthole. And I said, nah, it's too late for that. So they eventually left, and I sat on that curve, man, because it took me 30 minutes to get back in my car, because I was humiliated. It was the first time in my life that I felt less than a man. It was the first time in my life that the older generation and the grandparents that grew up where I'm from, and I listened to their stories coming up, it was a very similar story, but just in the modern era. And I just struggled with my manhood at that particular time. And I was crying, and I was more so crying because it's the first time in my life I heard my mother frantically cried through a phone. And when a mother is screaming to protect her son from being murdered. Like, that's a different cry. I don't even do it any justice in trying to explain that. And so when I saw the George Floyd video, I remember he was calling for his mom, but his mom had passed away 2 years ago. And so I could relate. That was shared values, and that emotion really triggered me. I never told that story till 15 years later, and the reason I never told that story was because I never wanted to affect Raymond's draft value. Because if you remember, in 2005, North Carolina won the national championship, but they lost their first game of the year versus Santa Clara. And they lost that game because Raymond didn't play. Raymond didn't play that game because he came and played in a summer league at the time on my team that I asked him to play in, and they had delayed the paperwork, and the summer league was never sanctioned by the NCAA on time. So as a result, they punished him a game, and I always felt guilty about that. So the last thing I wanted to do was feel guilty about bringing some, you know, negative drama his way with the police a month before he's about to get drafted. So after seeing the George Floyd video and the, you know, the Ahmaud Arbery's, and, you know, it's just a culmination of everything, I just felt the need to express it on Twitter.
North Carolina Central University head men's basketball coach continues to join us here after recounting a incredible story from 15 years ago and also when he was 12 about being targeted because of his race. Myron, go for it, man.
Well, always enjoy having you on the show, Coach. We had a chance to spend a lot of time together when I shadowed the team, rode the bus with the team for a week at North Carolina Central, one of the best experiences I've ever had. You revealed something to me that I think is important for people to know. You revealed that you had been diagnosed with an anxiety disorder a couple of years ago. And I think that's one of the things that's really not discussed in situations like this. How has the George Floyd video affected you mentally? And how do you move forward when you see something like that?
Man, it was interesting to say the least, because earlier last week, my wife was making me some of my favorite meals around the house, and I'm not eating them. And she's like, "What is wrong?" And I was like, "Nothing." And I just brush it off. And the reality was, that week, I had like two or three bad dreams slash nightmares. And I'm not a person that have dreams but all the time, but I'm a person that believe that your thoughts are manifested, you know, in your dreams. So anything that you think about consistently in fear is going to manifest in my dreams. And that story that I just told you, I woke up in cold sweats because I was reliving that through my dreams. And I was waking up at 3-4 in the morning. I couldn't sleep. I was tossing and turning. And it just made me extremely nervous, right? And I have severe anxiety disorder and PTSD. I got all of those things, and I've tried to be vocal about that as well to help people. And I'll tell you this, my mother probably stays like 35 minutes away from me. And my family and I, my wife and my son, Vail, he's 7, and my daughter, Brooke, is 11. We're in the car, and I'm going to my mom's house just to visit her. And I'm the guy that always drives well below the speed limit, right? I'm always the guy that's in the right lane. And I think it was Wednesday, my wife continues to look over from the passenger side, and she's looking at the speedometer, and she says, "I need you to slow down." And I look, and I'm going 45 miles an hour, and the speed limit is 50. And I look, and I'm like, "Man, just leave me alone. Like, what's going on with you?" So I continue to drive, and she said, "Vail," she looked at the speedometer again, she said, "Please slow down." And I look again, and now I'm going 45 again in a 50 miles an hour speed limit zone. And I just tell her, I get frustrated with her. I was like, "Look, just play on your phone or something. Like, don't be trying to tell me how to drive. You know, I'm going back at her." And she said, "You just don't get it." And I was like, "What you mean?" And this is while I'm driving. She said, "I don't need any built-in excuse for no cop to come up and possibly kill you in front of our family and my kids." And she had tears in her eyes when she said that. So now I'm continuing to drive, and I'm like, what kind of, like, they don't give you a parental class. It's no GPS on how to raise children with this seed planted in your mind. These are the things that affect us These are the things that affect our families. This is what affects us on a day-to-day basis, and I don't know how to fix it. But, you know, that's some of the things that play, you know, not only myself, but so many black men and their families across America.
Lavelle Moten joining us. I would like, I've gotten to listen to Myra Metcalf for the better part of 90 minutes here, and it's been really enlightening to me. I'm a white guy, father of four kids, ages 4 to 9, live in a predominantly white neighborhood, go to a school where it's probably 85% white. What would you, and I know I'm not alone in this in asking this question, what would you advise someone like me to do to help when I don't feel like there is much I can do to help?
Well, I would advise anyone that's not black who've had experiences that similar to the ones that I've explained is to, number one, don't feel like you can't help, right? Because I think that's been one of the glowing issues in America, that everyone just felt like, okay, these are your issues. I can't do anything, so I'm going to let you guys handle it. The reality is, historically, you know, we all know Las Vegas as this incredible place of entertainment with exotic strips and all of these great things right now. But the truth is, Vegas was one of the most segregated places on earth. That's until Frank Sinatra said, listen, if you guys want me to perform here, you better make sure my friend Sammy Davis Jr. is allowed to perform on the same stages as me and stay in the same hotels as me. The rest is history. And that was the inception of integration for Vegas and change in Vegas, right? A lot of people look at the historic 68 photo of the Olympics with John Carlos and Tommy Smith when they finished and they had the black gloves on the stand and had their fists raised. That's a historic photo. But what many people don't know is the guy on the stand with them, Peter Norman, who finished in the silver, was protesting with them also. He had a patch on for human rights, the Human Rights Project. I'm assuming all of us are old enough to know that or remember MTV when it was really music television, right? And all they played was videos. Well, they never played videos of people that looked like us. And that changed when one day they were interviewing David Bowie. And they said, man, you're an incredible pop star with some amazing videos. How do you make these videos? And he said, yeah, I'm a good pop star. And I have some amazing videos. But there's a guy by the name of Michael Jackson who's a really good singer. It has some incredible videos that you guys failed to play, and you need to start playing his videos. And that changed music television as we know it. So I guess what I'm saying is true change for black Americans have always come when white people and people that didn't look like us advocated on our behalf. And that's all we're asking at this particular time. As a men's basketball coach, and I've participated in so many challenges throughout the years, right? The Sandy Hook atrocity. We are a HBCU, and that, from my understanding, I think that was 2013-14. Forgive me if I get the years confused. My entire basketball team wore green bracelets and spoke out against Sandy Hook because that was an injustice that probably didn't affect people that looked like us, but it affected humans. That was us, and it was palpable to us. So I participated in so many challenges, the Sandy Hook, the Coaches versus Cancer, the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, and so on and so forth. But it seems as if, and this is my problem, I'm being completely honest.
Lavelle, we've got about 10 seconds here. I do want to get to what you just said. We're going to be right back. This is Sunday Morning on ESPN Radio. Lavelle Moten left us with the greatest cliffhanger of giving some great advice and then said, my biggest problem is, and then we had to cut him off because of the hard network out. So, Lavelle, pick up where you left off just with your advice and what you would give to white America.
Yeah, I was saying that, you know, as a black coach, I participated in a multitude of challenges, you know, from the ALS challenge to the Sandy Hook challenge to the Coaches versus Cancer, you know, you name it, I participated in it because my heart bled for humanity at that particular time. But it seems when the murder of young black men, come across the timelines of coaches, everyone is silent. And I have a major issue with that. And for years, I've never really said anything, but now I think enough is enough, because here's the harsh reality. We have coaches in Power Five, football and basketball coaches. The reality is a lot of these coaches have been able to create generational wealth. I mean, their grandkids' kids are going to be able to live a prosperous life, because athletes who were the complexion of George Floyd was able to run a football, throw a football, shoot a basketball, or whatever have you. So they have benefited greatly from athletes that look like George Floyd and many more. But whenever people, the complexion of George Floyd, is killed, assassinated, murdered in the street in broad daylight, they're silent. And I have a problem with that, because it seems as if black lives matter to them whenever they can benefit from it, right? Whenever they're getting them a first down, or, you know, catching a alley-oop or shooting a three or whatever. But when it's time for the humanity to speak up on behalf of those student-athletes, it's silence. It's cricket. And so my problem is if the murdering of black Americans is too risky of an issue for you to stand up as a leader, then who are they really playing for, right? Like, that right there is the problem within America, right? That therein lies the problem. And I have a major problem with that, because it seems their culture is good enough. I'm seeing coaches on social media dance and do all these TikToks, these latest TikTok dances, to say, oh, he's cool, to attract black athletes. And that's the only reason they're doing it. They're retweeting their accomplishments. They're retweeting all of this. They're saying, you know, our program have generated the most All-Americans and blah, blah, blah. And every time they tweet something, the majority of those players look like George Floyd, 90% of them. But yet and still, when these kids or these men are getting killed in the middle of broad daylight, no one has anything to say, in the silence, and they just wait until time passes and then they pick back up. And I just have a major problem with that, because that's how we eliminate this problem, when everyone stands up and advocate on their behalf. Like, it's not the blatant racism that we can't deal with. That's easily identifiable, right? But it's the guys that's pretending to say they love and care for us that's not speaking up on our behalf. That's the danger, right? Because you can see everything else coming. But when you can't see that, in the unknown, that's disguising themselves as 1-2-3 family, when they break huddles and disguising themselves as father's figures, then that's my main problem right there. And that's what we have to eliminate.
Coach, I'm curious, because I'm with you. I think everything you said, I hope everybody heard every word and listened to what you're saying. Here's my challenge. I don't want coaches to get away with tweeting the Martin Luther King Jr. quote and thinking they've done enough. I don't want coaches to get away with a retweet or saying what happened to George Floyd was wrong, and then they go back to their regularly scheduled programming. So how do we prevent that? What goes beyond the statements we're seeing this week in real change?
Well, you know, unfortunately, if you look at those, there'll be some of those statements come out, and they'll be so politically correct. And one of the problems I have with that, if you ever look at those statements, right, they never mention black people. It'll say something really politically correct, such as we have to do a better job as society and to making this America one again, and, you know, the injustices are disrespectful and blah. Like, it'll be those type of words, right? It'll never say, look, what's happening to these black men and these black women and these black kids and black people is straight up wrong, right? It's never those type statements. And so I'm a grown man, so I can see through all the BS. I don't accept the politically correct answers. Now, to answer your question, it's really difficult to change the mindset and mentality of anyone that's grown, right? So I think America is in such a distraught place that you're not changing the 45, 50-year-old man, because the craziest thing I've received since I tweeted, I've received so many emails and texts from college coaches and ADs saying, oh my goodness, your story changed everything. How I view my team, I have to do a much better job. Thank you for putting that out there, blah, 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 blah. And I won't expose them. But my thing is, don't send it to me. Like, tell your children. Tell your football team. Tell your basketball team. That's who really needs to hear it. And I just think, I did an interview the other day, and they asked me, where can we, you know, where can we begin to fix this situation? I said, this has been so ongoing. It's really, George Floyd was more so the straw that broke the camel back. If you look at what happened that previous week with Amy Cooper and her being in Central Park, of all places, and calling the cops on the young man, she called the cops in hopes of the cops arriving at that situation and that situation ending the way the George Floyd situation ended. That's why she called the cops. So, you know, it's really difficult to lead if you're not going to be honest. It's really difficult to be a leader if you're not going to take hard stands. It's really difficult to be a leader if you're not going to do what you're called to do. And as coaches, that's what we're called to do. And leadership just don't benefit me on the 1st and the 15th of each month when it's payday. Like, you have to make some harsh decisions, and this is one of them. And I don't think it's a harsh decision. I just think it's easy to see people getting killed in the street and for you to step up and say, nah, that's wrong.
Pretty powerful words. Lavelle Moton, North Carolina Central men's basketball coach that's based in Durham, joining us here on Sunday morning on ESPN Radio. Before we let you go, and again, it's been really 40 great minutes with you, as a men's basketball coach, as you said, of black players, what is going to be your message as the kids return to campus, or as you've reached out to them? How do you use this? What do you do with this now moving forward?
The reality is, we continue to do what we've always done. This don't change how I lead. This don't change how I coach. This don't change what I demand from them in life, because we've already addressed this issue. See, in our program, we have days where we go in the gym and we put four chairs together as if they're going to be a drivers, a passengers, and two back seats, and we play let's get pulled by the cops today. And this is how you react when the cop pull you, because your job is as a young man is to make it back home, right? So I don't need you being tough. I don't need you mouthing off. I want you to put your license when you go out. I want you to have your license on the dash where you're not reaching into no consoles or glove compartments, because we don't need any built-in excuses for these cops to have a reason to shoot or antagonize you. So when they approach, you keep two hands on the wheel. If you're going to reach for something, you ask him two times, sir, may I please reach for my license right now? And I don't even want you reaching for your license or anything. I want you keeping it on the dashboard. Matter of fact, do what my mentors told me when I was young. Memorize your driver's license number so you can tell them that instead of having to reach and they have issue. So that's how I always coach, to be honest with you. And I don't even consider myself a basketball coach. You know, I consider myself a life coach who use basketball as a metaphor to teach these valuable lessons, because I know what awaits them out here. And so this is an eye-opening, but when this is no longer a trending topic, we still got to deal with the harsh reality of preparing these young black men to enter into this world that exists under the conditions that we currently see.
Lavelle, we really appreciate you spending part of your Sunday morning with us. This has meant a lot, and your words will stick with us for a long time. Thank you, Lavelle.
No problem. Thank you guys for having me.